Welcome back to another episode of City Hall Pass. I'm Kapel Lungani, counsel to the mayor of New York City. We created this forum, the first of its kind in New York City, to give you, the public, a unique window into the highest levels of our city government. We interview New York City's finest public servants and get them to open up in a way that is both deeply personal and insightful. And on its best days, we hope that our podcast is equal parts educational and inspiring. And now I want to introduce my two co-hosts today, two brilliant women who inspire me every day, Bess Chu and Kate Coughlin.
Thanks, Kapel. Happy to be here. This is Bess Chu. I'm currently Chief of Staff to the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Hi, I'm Kate Coughlin, and I currently serve as Deputy Counsel for the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
I want to introduce our guest today, the Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence and Counterterrorism for the New York City Police Department, John Miller. In his current role, John oversees the Intelligence Bureau, the Counterterrorism Bureau, and the NYPD's partnership with the Federal Bureau of Investigation and NYPD's Joint Terrorism Task Force. He has served in this post since 2014. John is the former Deputy Assistant Director of National Intelligence for Analysis. Prior to that, he was an Assistant Director for the FBI, where he was in charge of public affairs, community outreach, and served as the Bureau's national spokesman. Along with his law enforcement career, John has worked in journalism as a senior correspondent for CBS News, reporting for CBS This Morning and CBS Evening News for 60 Minutes. He's a winner of 2 Peabody Awards and 11 Emmys. John is also a former ABC News correspondent and anchorman, perhaps best known for conducting a May 1998 interview with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. He is a co-author of the New York Times bestseller, The Cell, Inside the 9/11 Plot. We spoke to John for nearly 2 hours about his fascinating life, and it was such a great conversation that we had to split it into 2 parts. In part 1, you'll hear about John's childhood growing up as the son of a journalist in New York City, his journey from a local crime reporter to Nightline news anchor, and his fascinating stories covering the New York City mafia. We hope you enjoy.
It gives me great pleasure to welcome John Miller, the Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence and Counterterrorism, to City Hall Pass. John, thank you so much for joining us today. It's really a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. This will be fun.
Kate, Bess, and I have really been looking forward to this for weeks on end. I don't think there is anybody in city government who's had a career like John. And today, we're going to get into his extraordinary career. John, your father was a columnist and a freelance writer. Did your father inspire you to be a journalist? And why did journalism appeal to you?
It appealed to me because from the time I was 7, he started taking me around. It was just this really odd thing because here you are, 7 years old, and what's happening? And you're there. And I realized from a very early age that the golden ticket wasn't from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. The golden ticket was a press card from the New York City Police Department because it was the guaranteed ticket to a front row seat to anything that was going on. So when the anti-war demonstrations were happening at Columbia University, I was there. It was 1968. I was 10, but I saw it and it helped me understand it. When the astronauts came back from the moon, it was 1971 and it was outside City Hall and they had a ticker tape parade up Broadway and I wasn't in the crowd. I was right there and rode behind them in a car for the parade. So going to school, when they could say, what did you do this weekend? Well, we played softball, you know, we did frisbee. I'm like, oh, I was at, you know, a building collapse in Queens. It was a very interesting way to grow up. And, you know, he was all about New York news in the daytime, but also New York at night. So when Sammy Davis opened at the Copacabana, you were sitting ringside. When Frank Sinatra played, you know, you were up in the dressing room. I had an unreasonable expectation as a little boy that this would be normal. So I had to gravitate into those jobs that put you right there. And I always have. So by the time I was in the 8th and 9th grade, going from middle school to high school, my pictures were being published. I was in the Newark riots. I was at crime scenes in New York. That was the thing about being a photographer and about journalism. If you wanted to be an astronaut, you had to wait till you were old enough and go into the Air Force or the Navy and make your way there. If you wanted to be a detective, you had to join the police department and go through the academy. I mean, what could you do right now if you were 14 or 12? And the fact was that if you got the picture that nobody else got, you were going to be on the front page. And they didn't care that you were 12. So at that point, You know, when a call came over the radio in my father's car, I would say, let's go faster.
So you were using your father's press pass at that point?
Well, he was the real golden ticket because I would be with him. And then in 1973, when I was probably 14, I guess, or 15, I managed through circuitous route to get my own press pass by posing as a messenger who was picking it up for the important photographer, John Miller, because I knew that if I went to pick it up as John Miller, they would take one look at me and say, are you even allowed out by yourself? That this was the old police headquarters at 240 Center Street, you know, in 1972. And I remember walking out the door like a bank robber leaves, you know, looking behind you to see if anybody was chasing you. And I got in the car with my dad and I showed him the press card and I said, I got it.
What's the most thrilling moment you remember with your father on one of these stories?
It's hard to say because the thrilling moments were not the ones you would expect. It was the thrill of the chase, not getting there. You know, you would be on Broadway at 57th Street, stop for a piece of pizza. Dad would come back to the car and we'd kind of put all the food out. And Murphy's Law, destiny of people who have to wait for things to happen to succeed, always dictated that the minute you put like the cups on the dashboard and laid out the pizza on the armrest, that the big call came in and it would all go flying. But it was, you know, speeding down Broadway for that report of a shooting, you know, in Times Square and weaving through the traffic and the police cars coming in from both sides of the intersection and the cacophony of lights and sirens and you'd screech to a halt and the doors would fly open. And those were the more thrilling moments about what was about to happen. And I remember thinking, God forgive me, I love it. And why shouldn't I? Because I'm in the sixth grade.
So we heard that you started as a crime reporter because you slept in your car and listened to police scanners. And then you would be the first one to show up on the scene, even sometimes before the police. What drew you to crime?
Well, it was the idea that I don't think, you know, if you were a young reporter breaking in, they were going to assign you to cover City Hall or, you know, the State House. Crime was the break-in place for every reporter. You know, you start on the police beat. And in probably the most serious case of professional arrested development, I started on the crime beat and stayed there forever. Because to me, politics was about power and sports was about winning or losing. Finance was about money. But crime reporting was where the stakes were always the highest. Crime reporting was about who was going to live, who was going to die, who was going to go to jail. It was the ultimate high stakes, which meant it came with the depth of storytelling and drama that couldn't be matched by anything else. If you flip around the dial, even today on the television, there's three kinds of stories. There's sitcoms, which are funny. People need that. All the rest are either crime dramas or about people in the emergency room, doctors, because that's where the stakes are highest. And that's where the storytelling is richest.
When you show up to these scenes, and here you are as a teenager, how did you get witnesses and police officers to talk to you?
Well, by the time I had put my camera aside to go into television, the way you got them to talk to you was you showed up with a TV camera and a camera crew, and people are either repelled by that or drawn to it. The early experiences, those are lessons in humanity. You know, you're starting out, you're on the crime beat. You're starting out, you're on the weekends. The weekends usually started with a fire in the winter, some heating device went awry. A family was burned out. Maybe people died in that case. And I would always show up. And the last thing I wanted to do was to bother the family. You know, you see these crass things on television, people sticking microphones in people's faces and asking inane questions like, how does it make you feel, this terrible tragedy? And I wanted to keep a distance from that because even as a kid, I felt that was uncomfortable. And leaving one fire scene in the morning, a kid ran up to us and said, but the mother's waiting for you. Aren't you going to go talk to them? And I said, well, sure we are. And I began to realize that this was almost tied to economics. You know, if you were in a gated community and there was a crime, nobody wanted to talk to you. They wanted to stay behind their walls. But if you were in a community where people feel invisible, unlistened to, without a voice, when tragedy struck, they wanted those voices to be heard, even in the worst times. So I had to adjust my thinking about when and how to approach people. I mean, you learn a lot in the street when you start out.
John, what was your first job in journalism?
My first actual job was at Channel 5 News. Today it's Fox. Back then it was Metro Media. And it was the scrappy local station. I had taken to giving tips to a reporter there named Marvin Scott, went on to Channel 11. We all know him from Channel 11 today. Marvin basically figured out he had two choices. He was either going to have to go to court and get an order of protection to make me stop calling him, or he was going to get me a job in the newsroom so I would just be there and leave him alone. So when I was 14, I started there, and my job was three things. I was very adept by then, having 7 years of steady listening to the police radio, at picking up what were the right calls to focus on and making sure the assignment editor knew. The other was to go out for coffee or whatever anybody asked you to do. And the third was to pick up film from the lab because video and live hadn't been invented yet. And then one day, there was a building collapse in Bayside, Queens. And it was a disaster. There were people trapped in the rubble. The fire department was there. The emergency service unit was there. And I called the news desk to make sure that they hadn't missed it because I was with my dad in the car. The guy answering the phone answered all the phones at once, put them all on hold, and then one at a time said to the guys from the lab, come back to the lab, we're going to have late film. The camera crew from the Madison Square Garden dropped the basketball game, head to Bayside. He picked up the phone that was supposed to have the reporter on it, but he had the wrong phone. So he barked the instruction to me to get out to the scene and cover the story. Who was I to argue?
I mean, when the door opens, you go through it, right?
Right. I mean... I told my dad, like, step on it, because there's no reporters, apparently, so I'm covering the story. And I went and I interviewed Commissioner O'Hagan from the fire department and victims and witnesses, and then you had to run the film back. Remember, the live shot didn't exist. This was 1973. I got back. The thing went on the air. The guy who ordered me on the phone said, where's, you know, what's his name? I'm like, I'm what's his name? He said, who the hell are you? I said, I work here 3 days a week after school. He said, who told you to cover this story? I said, you did. He said, oh my God. So that was Sunday night, which happened to be the highest rated news show of the week because everybody's home for the 10 o'clock news. On Monday, a small inquest was conducted on the part of the news director and vice president to determine how it came to pass that a ninth grader had covered the lead story on the news. But that was my start. And then after that, whenever there was a story that came in too late or all the reporters were already assigned or it was 9:30 and you had, you know, 10 minutes to get there, 10 minutes to shoot it and 10 minutes to get it back, I worked on the night desk because I worked after school. So I got to cover a lot of stories through my teenage years there.
John, you covered, obviously, a lot of incredible people during your time as a reporter. You were also placed in many dangerous situations as a reporter. Any particular situation, famous or not, where you really thought, you know, maybe my zeal to get the news here, maybe I crossed the line here. I put myself in a place where I may not make it out of.
I had a couple of times when, because of my youthful appearance and relative anonymity at Channel 5, where I went undercover in different investigative stories. And I can remember one night in particular doing an undercover operation on 3rd Avenue and 54th Street about exploitation of a child. It was a child prostitution story and ended up in a car with a guy who pulled a gun out. And I'm like, okay, you're in a car. You're a teenager. There's a guy next to you holding a gun. And he put it away and the conversation continued. It was just about maintaining your cool in a difficult situation, which came in handy. You know, I ended up in Colombia doing the stories on the cartels. And that was a very dangerous environment to operate in as a journalist because you didn't have the kind of protection that journalism offers in America. There were, you know, war zones in Bosnia and Israel and other places. But that is not special to me. There are journalists who go out there and face danger all the time to bring that news from the front lines of different stories. And I was never alone. You know, there was always a camera person and a sound person, and you work as a team.
How long did you spend covering the cartels in Colombia?
That was the 80s. And, you know, I wasn't really covering the cartels in Colombia as much as I was covering the drug-associated violence that was plaguing New York City at the time. You remember, you know, the 80s and what it was like, cocaine and crack, and where was it coming from and who was profiting. And it just seemed to really understand that story. You had to go down and find out, you know, who was Gonzalo Rodriguez Gacha and who were, you know, the cartel bosses in Medellin and in Cali, show the houses they lived in and the way they lived. You know, it was interesting because, you know, you would go to these houses. You know, you think you're in New York, like, you know, you're going to go to the mob boss's house and they're going to tell you to go away. I mean, people disappeared down there. But we got some very sharp local fixers and it was a very interesting series.
When you're in situations like that and you've been in situations like Medellin, of course, you well known for the Osama bin Laden interview, while you do have your crew, you're clearly outnumbered and you have your sound guy, you have some local fixers. Understanding where your career has taken you, when you look back and you think about the places you put yourself in order to be here today, you had to develop a knack for who to trust and who not to trust, who was credible and who wasn't. That's obviously a critical component of your job now as the Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence and Counterterrorism. When you look back upon those days, was that a skill that you developed over time, or are you just good at reading people? Have you always been good at that?
So the key to reading people is reading people, which is the more you do it, the better sense you get out of it. There's no real class that you can go to do that. Unfortunately, the learning curve is, you know, how many times you learn the hard way that you read people wrong. That helps you read people in the future. But the real key in those kinds of travels to the most dangerous places is the person they call the fixer. And the fixer is going to be a local guy or a local woman. And they're the people who, they're from the area, they know the territory, they have the contacts. If you're a journalist, you know, you have to be a neutral party. And they have to think that they're going to get a fair telling, not a positive telling, but a fair telling of the story. So if you have a reputation as a reporter who's fair, and you have a fixer who's a known quantity and trusted, who's brought other people through, those are the keys to staying safe. And, you know, the journalist always wants to push. I want to go the extra mile. I want to go the extra mile. I want to go the extra 3 feet. I want to go the extra foot. And it's the fixer, that local person you hire that's worked with journalists who says, no, this is as far as we go. Because that's the person with the experience as to where the tensions are set in the environment. And that's what keeps you alive.
So you mentioned earlier that crime is an area of the richest storytelling. And in the 1980s in New York City, you covered the mafia here. I actually was a child in Staten Island at the time. And so we would hear things in the news about the Toad Hill section of Staten Island where there are beautiful houses, mansions, really.
The other White House.
Yes. And then there was the other White House and there were members of the mafia who lived there.
The White House was the name that they had given to Paul Castellano's house because he had designed it to look like the White House as a symbol of his power as a mob boss.
You were known as a reporter who could break stories about the Gambino crime family. And I know earlier you spoke about how, you know, and being a reporter, one of the key things was being a fair storyteller. How did you build that relationship as a reporter with the Gambino crime family?
Well, the Gambino crime family was a family in transition. I had covered the mob for years. The mob wanted nothing to do with the press. I mean, when we encounter the mob, it's because somebody got shot or killed, there was a rub out or a hit, or people got caught in the crossfire. And if you had the right police contacts, you usually knew what the internecine battles between the five crime families of New York were, and you could kind of map out what that war was about. John Gotti was the game changer because when he decided to take over the family, he murdered the man who lived in the White House, Paul Castellano. Paul Castellano was an old-style mob boss. He was the boss of the Gambino crime family. He had been the son-in-law of Carlo Gambino, for whom the family was named, and he ran it in an old-style way. He shunned the press. He shunned attention. He shunned the spotlight. You know, as a manager, he kept his distance from the street. He insulated himself from operations. He was looked at within the crime family as being both aloof and greedy. I don't want to see you and I don't want to know you if I don't have to, but make sure that envelope of the cash comes here every week. And if it's late, you're going to hear from me. So when John Gotti rubbed out Castellano, it was December 16th, 1985. So it's a few days before Christmas. It's in the heart of Midtown Manhattan. It's on a busy cross street in the 40s on 3rd Avenue. Christmas music is playing over the loudspeakers from the office buildings. The lights are up, and there are two bodies in the street, Castellano and his drivers. There could not have been a more public, a more brash, a more bold statement that all bets were off in organized crime. And I remember, as a 26-year-old reporter standing on that street corner doing a live shot saying, this is the body of Big Paul Castellano, and his murder in this public way, in this public place, can only signal two things: that the mob's ruling body, the commission, has authorized the killing of one of its own, or that someone within the families has broken all the rules and it is the precipice for war. An investigator from NYPD took me by the elbow and walked me down the street. It's somebody I'd known for years and trusted. And he said, the guy you got to look at is John Gatti. He didn't even pronounce it right. He meant Gatti. And I said, Gatti? Who's Gatti? And he said, you know, he's a captain for the Gambino family in Queens. And, you know, there's been rumblings he was going to make a move. So the next morning, I staked out his place, waited for him to come out, chased him with a camera crew, and asked him, you know, if he was behind the Castellano hit, if he was the new boss. And this was the thing about John Gatti. There's art imitating life. Imitating art, imitating life. He dressed like a gangster in the $2,000 pinstripe suits from, you know, a store called Delisi on 54th Street. Had the gruff, raspy voice and would throw out the quick sound bites, you know, as you tracked him. And I remember thinking, this guy is going to be irresistible to the public because he looks like the gangster from the movies, not like old Paul Castellano or old Carlo Gambino. And he walked with a strut. And I thought to myself, somewhere in Chicago in 1928, there was some 26-year-old reporter for the Chicago Tribune who was covering Al Capone and didn't know that this was a historic moment in the telling of crimes. And I said, this guy is our Al Capone. And stuck with Gatti for 7 years because he was, in substance, the boss of a crime family that controlled things from the fish market to the convention center to the concrete business to the carpenters union to gambling to loan sharking to racketeering of all kinds. So in substance, he was somebody that New Yorkers needed to know about. But beyond the substance, when you get to style, there was the thing that made people really interested in him, because he beat the first case at trial by fixing the jury and the second case at trial by fixing the jury. And then he became the Teflon Don. There was a balance, actually, that you had to stay with in the storytelling at the risk of glorifying him, which was he's a dangerous leader of a mob family that costs you, you know, if you eat a piece of fish, they're costing you money. If you go into an office building, it costs you money. If you have a piece of linen on the table, he's costing you money. But people romanticized him.
How do you stick with a crime boss for as many years as you did?
So that was not easy. You have to become a surveillance expert. You have to get his pattern of life. You have to figure out if you're following him and you lose him, where you can find him again based on that pattern of life. And, you know, in 7 years, you get to know your quarry pretty well. There was a lot of tension in the beginning. But after a while, it just seemed to wear him down that he expected to see me popping out of a doorway or walking down the street with a camera crew. He expected me to ask him questions and he expected to answer them in brief with some quip. It was like covering a company, a corporate entity, and its competitor, because with all the sources that were developed over those times, you could know what the pressures were in the family, what the upcoming investigations were going to do, who the targets were, likely the next one to be bumped off. And it was very addicting, both to me as the reporter, but also as the audience, at following this character, because he was compelling.
What do you think the value was to him or to the family in being so public and being interviewed compared to, you know, kind of the old school guys?
That is a really interesting question because it defies logic even in its obviousness, but based on how he conducted himself. The mafia is a secret society. It comes with a code of silence. So therefore, to look like who you are and act like who you are and, you know, walk like a duck and talk like a duck and, you know, you're a gangster, beg the question why. And we had talked about leadership before, management style, running a corporate entity. This applies as well to gangsters as it does to terrorist organization leaders, as it does to the head of any big American company. There are some core principles that come into play there. Castellano, under Castellano, the corporate entity of the Gambino crime family ran like a top. Orders came down, money came up, profits were huge, risk was mitigated in terms of not getting caught and prosecuted as well as they could. Under John Gotti, you had a guy who had much better leadership skills with people, meaning he was not aloof, he was not distant. He was out there with the men of the Gambino crime family, and I say men because it's not a job open to women. He was in the clubs, he was in the street, he was backslapping and hugging, and people were kissing him. And to the crime family, it was, to the street guys, it was finally, we've got a boss who's out there with the people. You know, John Gotti was out there, and they really appreciated that. But that was in terms of person-to-person leadership. There are two places in the corporate structure where he failed. One, the Gambino crime family wasn't running like a top. Even though his leadership was very popular among the men, all the attention he was bringing on himself was degrading the corporate entity of this mob family. Number two, even the greatest leader can make bad personnel choices. And by choosing Sammy Gravano as his underboss, who every time he got crosswise with somebody in a business deal, whether they were in the mob or not, they ended up getting killed. That brought repeated heat. It collected enemies, and it made Gotti the guy who had to check the box when Sammy said, I want to kill this guy. You know, he said, this guy, Sammy Gravano, every time he gets a new business partner, I got to kill the guy. And that amounted to 19 murders. A good corporate leader would have said, my deputy seems to have a lot of self-interest that transcends risk to the organization. Maybe I need a different deputy. In the end, it was Gravano whose self-interest said, well, when it's now me against the boss, instead of the code of silence and going away for life and keeping my mouth shut, let's make a deal. Management style versus management substance versus personnel choices. These things count no matter what organization you're leading.
Of all the mafia bosses, who do you think was the best leader?
I would say Frank Costello, the chairman of the board of the mafia at the most pivotal time. It's when Las Vegas was coming up, and it was when New York was critical to that. He was the boss of what would end up becoming the Genovese crime family, although at the time it might as well have been the Costello family. You know, Frank was a guy about town, which meant that my dad, who knew everybody, you know, ran into Frank at the Copa, saw him, you know, at Salka choosing ties, and became friends with him. And when Frank Costello was kind of at the height of his power, my father and my mom had dinner with him and his wife, Bobby, at Monsignor, which was a great restaurant in Midtown. I claim to have been there. It was 1958, but that's because I think my mom was pregnant with me at the time. So it's a technical claim. But when Frank left the restaurant, he took a cab to the Majestic, and a hitman walked up behind him and shot him in the head. But he said, Frank, this one's for you, which caused him to turn. And the bullet actually grazed the side of his head, separated the brim from his fedora from the main part of the hat. And Frank ran inside the building and kind of went on to retire alive and well and move to Florida. But when you talk about a mob boss's ability to corrupt government, corrupt the political process, who had judges and, you know, political leaders on the payroll, who knew newspaper men like my dad. I'm not suggesting my dad was corrupt, but he was a guy who socialized enough to truly treat it like a corporate entity, to bring it further and further into the white collar world of society, where it became insidious in terms of taking over legitimate businesses and labor unions and things. I think he set the path that brought the mob towards its greatest success, and the path that people like John Gotti kind of veered off of.
I want to thank our guest, the Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence and Counterterrorism for the NYPD, John Miller, for joining this podcast. As I mentioned at the top of the program, this is just part one of our fascinating chat with John. So stay tuned for part two, where he'll break down in detail his 1998 interview with Osama bin Laden and much more. We hope you enjoyed this conversation and are looking forward to talking to you soon on another episode of City Hall Pass.
This podcast is brought to you by the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor of New York City.